Hello, this week's Brewing Podcast is with me, Guy Foster, speaking to Chris Williamson of The Market, who produced the broadest cross-section of business purchasing managers surveys in the world. It's insightful, but not intended as investment advice. The insights that Chris has access to are unparalleled in terms of their timeliness, but bear in mind, we can't guarantee sources from outside Brew and Dolphin. Tax legislation allowances can change. And remember, markets PMIs help to give a good indication of how the economy is performing. But when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values may increase or decrease as a result of currency fluctuations, and future performance may differ from that of the past. Now, with that said, let's dig into these surveys and find out what's going on in the global economy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Brewing Podcast with me, Guy Foster, the head of research at Brewing Dolphin, and very pleased to be joined on this occasion for this podcast by none other than Chris Williamson. And Chris Williamson is the chief economist of Market. Market produced a range of purchasing managers index surveys, which you may be familiar with the concept of, seeing as we recently had a podcast with ISM, who produce a largely US-based survey of how economies are producing. So we love these surveys because they are as close as you can get to real-time kind of indicators of how businesses feel their activity levels are developing. And we're very pleased, as I said, to be joined by Chris on this podcast. So Chris, thanks very much for joining us. Welcome to the podcast. We've seen the final purchasing managers indices for the month of August, just over the last few days. Can you briefly summarize what these data can, and maybe, you know, if you feel that it's necessary, maybe what they can't tell us about how the economy is functioning at the moment?
Hi. Yeah. All right. Quite a broad ranging question there. So let's try to give a sort of overview from the global perspective, because these surveys, they we've got 28,000 companies around the world replying to our surveys now. And these are in each country, it's a representative panel that we've built. So US manufacturing, a representative panel, China manufacturing or Indian services. So we get the right mix of companies, if you like, to represent each economy. So this all feeds into this number. And it's been a quite a roller coaster, obviously, in 2020 so far, with that global PMI, that headline number measures the output of these firms. And that obviously fell to a record low at the height of the pandemic in April, as all these lockdowns hit factories and service sector companies. Since then, we've seen quite a robust rebound globally. And this is reflected in part these factories simply reopening, and as social distancing measures ease, we've caught that in service sectors. So August, we had the fastest growth for around 1.5 years. So it's not booming, right? It's recovering. It's certainly going to indicate that global GDP has risen quite markedly in the third quarter, compared to this collapse we had in the second quarter. So that's the first takeaway, really. You know, we're on the road to recovery. That's the first thing you can see from these surveys. Secondly, it's a quite a mixed picture, and it's interesting to see where you can see when countries that locked down first, for example, have rebounded most sharply. No surprise there, of course. China being the obvious one. China's lockdown was in February. It's rebounded quite markedly. What's interesting with China is that, although it was kind of March when it started to rebound and April more firmly, it's that rebound has still persisted into August. So this is encouraging, right? It's not a sort of a bounce and fade thing. Certainly in China, that's not been evident yet. But of course, the key thing is China's had a great success in keeping its infection levels down. And so its level of COVID containment is very modest. We can measure the degree of lockdown. We've got economists all around the world who collect government measures on the extent to which different aspects of the economy are locked down, whether it's travel restrictions or forced business closures or school closures and so forth. And we know China now has, I think globally, one of the lowest levels of lockdown. So it's not surprising that you've got these numbers quite buoyant. What we saw in July and August, though, is where infection numbers rose, in particular in Italy and Spain, and to some extent the US, you had some sort of cooling of the rebound already evident. This is most worryingly so in Spain and Italy. Now, that cooled the pace of Eurozone expansion. So these growth rates are somewhat more subdued than you would have had if you hadn't had these infection rates rising. And globally, if you look at it, you've got factories rebounding most sharply, a really nice upturn there, even in countries with quite severe lockdowns, if you like. The global factory situation's improving as trade picks up, Asia and China leading that, for example. But it's the service sectors where we're getting the most disparities regionally around the world. China's doing okay. The US is, in fact, doing okay as well. But it's in Europe where you've got these service sector levels keep being subdued, the UK being a notable exception.
So when you're asking the questions you're always asking to your respondents are, well, how's your business doing from one month to the next, isn't it? Rather than what's your output in measured in dollars and stuff like that. So are you able to take those results and ascertain how close we are to, say, our pre-COVID levels of output, or is that too difficult to do from these results?
Yeah, that is difficult. You can sort of back the data out and compare it with official numbers and get some idea of where you are on recovery paths. We did supplement the regular monthly survey with questions about where companies were in relation to their recovery paths, which was quite fascinating. The average, so this, we did this one back in June, and the most highly developed recoveries, for example, were perceived in China and the US, where companies thought in a matter of 3 months they'd be back on average to pre-COVID output levels. In Europe it was much longer, and India much longer, Japan much longer as well, but it looks like US and China were very strong there. We're going to be repeating that in October, so we'll get another picture there of how that's progressed. But for the PMIs themselves, so these are factual questions with a typical question is your output higher, the same or lower than 1 month ago? The number of people employed in your firm, is that higher, the same or lower than 1 month ago? So these are fact-based questions. It's not opinion. So it does, it does give you the same sort of recourse to the actual trend in output rather than sentiment and so forth. So it's a kind of halfway house between those official data and the sentiment surveys, really.
And you're confident that people are able to answer those fact-based questions in the sort of very literal way that they're asked, because I think there's been some commentary, and it sort of appears a bit to us as well, that just in some instances it looks more like people are kind of commenting on their activity levels relative to a kind of a sort of a sense of new, of what would be a normal level, rather than the strict question, as you say, is sort of, well, is your output higher or lower than last month?
Yeah, so yeah, there's been lots of noise around the surveys, especially around the pandemic, and the two things really are, hang on, this is a sentiment survey, so take it with a pinch of salt. And secondly, it's not capturing the month-on-month volatility that we're seeing in some of the official data. Now, in terms of sentiment, if you compare the PMI with actual sentiment surveys, then you see some really interesting things, and that is that the PMI leads that sentiment. An example is the IFO survey in Germany, the biggest sentiment survey of German business. And their current conditions index is very closely watched. Now that's an index of, you know, how do you see the current economic climate? And that's similar to other surveys you see where, you know, where some benchmarking relative to normal. Now the PMI tends to, well, that IFO survey, for example, it leads it by 5 months because we're capturing this change in actuals. And you see the same thing with like European Commission sentiment surveys and so forth. So you can demonstrate quite easily that the PMI is leading sentiment. So it's therefore not sentiment. You know, these data are being collected around the same time. So we're actually capturing true movements in things like production, order books and employment. It is then filtering through to sentiment. There's a lag in that sentiment because, of course, companies see the news flow, you know, Eurozone's in recession, whatever, and they start getting gloomy, and that comes through the sentiment surveys. So it's a consistent lead there. And the other main thing is, look, companies are probably looking at something like, how is it not against last month, but a year ago? Now, that doesn't apply either, because, again, when you look at the comparisons, the PMI leads year-on-year changes in things like industrial production and GDP and so forth. Again, the leads around 5 to 6 months. So companies aren't looking at how it is a year ago. Now, what we see most evidently is we don't pick up the monthly change with all the noise, but we do tend to correlate very highly where the sort of 3 month on 3 month rate of change. And the research that we've done in talking to companies is that when they respond, they are looking at how things are changing month to month, but sometimes their interpretation of what's a significant change might be different. Right. So for example, if you know you've had a complete collapse of output and a very minor rise, they're still they're looking at it thinking, well, hang on, you know, this isn't good. I don't want to say things are better because, you know, really we're still being absolutely crushed here. And as far as we can see from our order book situation, there's no turnaround in this at any time moment. So they will still give a negative reply. And only when they're getting a more robust picture that there's a significant, substantial improvement in production going on that's being reinforced by orders, do they start giving a positive reply. Which is actually one of the real benefits of the surveys. And that's why people like the European Central Bank and the Bank of England like these surveys, because they don't tend to give false signals as to turning points. And an example is, you know, if you look at UK industrial production, or sorry, manufacturing output more precisely, over the last 20 years prior to the pandemic, you had 20 occasions when the quarterly rate of change fell into decline, signalling perhaps a worrying downturn. But it was only on six of those occasions that this actually turned into a substantial downturn, such as the global financial crisis, for example. The rest of the time, these were false signals. Because it just bounced straight back up again. And it may have been something like, you know, a car plant shutting production, or a big aircraft order or something like that had boosted production. Something had distorted the data. But what was interesting is whenever that quarterly rate of decline was seen, but if the PMI was above 50, it always bounced back. And only when it fell into decline and the PMI was also below 50 that it became a more serious worrying downturn. And the same thing seen in the Eurozone. So the PMI is really helpful in giving you an idea of how serious the situation is. If you are below 50, then it really does mean that you're going to get a serious contraction going on. And to look at the PMI in conjunction with those official data to see whether you're getting false signals is hugely valuable. So it's picking up that more the breadth of upturns and downturns that invariably gives you a sense of how serious the situation is in terms of expansion or contraction.
Okay, well, I think that's a great note to actually look at some of the sort of more granular data on. And obviously the indices are composed of some sub indices. I think they get lots of attention from commentators, economists, investors, and probably one of the most important at the moment would be the employment sub indices. So I think in we've had a contrast of measure of impressions, really, just over the over this recent set of results. At a global level, the employment position looks to be improving and getting quite close to stable. At a UK level, particularly in the important services sector, I thought the recent results were very, very disappointing. Are you able to share a bit more insight as to how those series are developing?
Yeah, no, it's quite a fascinating picture emerging behind that headline level. So, as we mentioned, you know, if you look globally at the moment, of the major developed and emerging markets, the fastest output growth in August was seen in the UK, with services rebounding sharply, joining this manufacturing upturn. The next fastest was Russia, China, and then the US, with the Eurozone lagging, India and Japan in contraction. So, you know, face value, the UK's seeing the best recovery, according to the PMIs, with the US lagging and Eurozone even further behind that. But then look at the other indices and you get a more nuanced picture. So what you see in the US, for example, is that this output growth is being supported by rising backlogs of work. So this is orders that companies have received, but not yet actually been able to process and complete. So these US companies have got, if you like, their order book pipeline really building quite nicely. And in fact, lots of companies, they're struggling to service demand. They can't get enough people in, they can't get enough capacity up and running to service that demand. In the UK, it's a completely different situation, whereby the output surge that we've seen is leading to a big drop in backlogs of work. So it's being fueled by companies eating into orders placed previously, not an influx of new ones. And the corollary of that really is the employment numbers. So in the US, that need to build capacity is driving a rise in employment. And in the UK, we're seeing the reverse of that, where jobs are being cut at increasing rates because companies are saying, look, we've just not got enough work to support output growth as it is at the moment. So it's very interesting, I think, series of indicators about how sustainable these recoveries are looking. The obvious conclusion is that the US is looking a little bit more resilient in terms of the next few months, whereas the UK looks very much prone to a bounce and fade, given what companies are looking at in terms of their hiring policies.
Yeah, I guess I think a lot of us have been perhaps pleasantly surprised by how strong the demand side has been holding up so far during this downturn. So, and do you think demand is on a different trajectory in those different regions?
It's to some extent, but you've got to look at the policies as well that are in place. The UK, it's in a complete false reality at the moment. You've got the furlough scheme, which is still ongoing, but it's being wound down. And you've got, you know, August was fueled by the Eat Out to Help Out. By far and away, the fastest growing service sector in the UK in August was the restaurant sector. And obviously, that was encouraging more people to go out when that. Sorry, not just go out to eat, but actually to get out. That was, I guess, you know, part of the plan there. So that's been taken away now as well. So that false reality will come back to haunt us somewhat, I suspect, in coming months. If the stimulus and those support policies are taken away, you're going to see the real underlying situation. So you've got to bear in mind that all these results need to be looked at in the context of what governments have been doing to keep that short-term economic growth while we, you know, hopefully get through these terrible times.
And have you seen, has it been possible to see any impact of the failure to pass new stimulus measures in the US yet? Or is that too timely even for the PMI?
Yeah, but we have seen their growth stymied by the lockdown measures. You know, I refer to those COVID containment indices that we calculate the degree of lockdown. Now, in the US was quite unusual in that in both July and August, the average level of containment lockdown, if you like, in July and August increased, and that put pressure on companies. We saw a lot more companies, because one of the things about PMIs, companies don't just say whether their output increased or decreased or stayed the same. They also were invited to give us a reason why it changed, so we can parse that, we can look through all that and try and get some insights into what's causing this. And that's what our commentary is really fed on. And what we saw in the US is the concerns about the lockdowns being reimposed, the impact on that, and the detrimental impact that had on the, you know, just how long is this going to go on for? You know, we're going to see wave after wave after wave. And this was the big fear. If you start reintroducing lockdowns, it knocks confidence to the extent that firms then start getting a little bit more pessimistic about their longer term prospects. And that's what we saw in the US to some extent.
So you commented a bit on the fact that in the US in particular there's been some constraints on supply. I don't know if through any of those comments that you get from companies you're able to shed a bit more light on the kind of problems that companies have had with supply chains, with production, you know, those kind of more supply side challenges that they've experienced.
So we have a number of questions that we ask in terms of how many materials companies are purchasing, their inventories of those purchases, and similarly the average lead times in the supply of inputs and the average price they pay for them. And what we saw globally at the height of the pandemic was supply chain delays of a degree that we'd never before seen, which, you know, would be expected as China's factories closed in particular. Supply was absolutely crushed. Now, normally what you'd see is when supply shortages develop like this, prices rise sharply. But what we saw that was unusual is that prices kind of on average remained fairly stable. Now that's because demand got absolutely crushed. So you had these forces pulling in different ways, supply shortages pulling prices up, whereas demand pulling them down. So it left a sort of stable, more or less, you know, slight fall in price situation. Now what you've had more recently is those supply chains have started to ease, although there's still lots of shortages because there's huge backlogs still to work through in those supply chains. But at the same time, demand's picking up. So you are seeing price pressures develop now, notably in the US, more than anywhere else, from memory. And that's related to this increasing demand with still some sort of residual supply shortages, meaning that suppliers have the pricing power at the moment. Although, interestingly, globally, you see exchange rates very much play a role here. So, with the weakened dollar, for example, that's exacerbating these price pressures. Whereas in the Eurozone, it's keeping prices low, much to the, you know, concern of the European Central Bank, no doubt. But you know, it's quite interesting there, where you're seeing very sharp input price increases in the US, but actually falling input prices in the Euro area. But then when you look at, because the other question is, well, what are companies actually charging for their goods and services? That generally is being kept very low. Now that's the, you know, intense competition that's around, because although, you know, these output indices are rising, showing recovery, it's still well below pre-pandemic levels. So companies are sort of fueling this growth by discounting, competing on price, and that's keeping these inflation pressures at bay at the moment.
There's been lots of challenges in the emerging markets. Lots of emerging markets seem to have been, I guess, relatively late in suffering the impact of COVID and still feeling it in full force at the moment. But I thought one of the most striking PMI results was the big rebound that we've seen in Brazil, and I think contrasted in your own publication how it doesn't, how it looks in contrast to Mexico, where the results are still very suppressed. So have you any insight as to what's driving that differentiation?
Yeah, there's a very big spread, if you like, between super strong growth. This is in manufacturing, really, we're looking at.
Yeah.
Super strong growth in Brazilian manufacturing now, but continued decline in Mexico. And if we, again, look through these reasons and the sub-indices, we can get some colour. I don't know whether we can explain it all. I mean, the surge in Brazilian manufacturing, I mean, there's a big auto surge going on there that's helping fuel other industries as well, less evident in Mexico. I think maybe, you know, Mexico's proximity to the US and the hit that it's had there, still playing catch up, really. I know US is recovering, but there's still a hit there to Mexico more than Brazil that we can see from the US. We see it in the responses, you know, damaged exports to the US. And in fact, Mexico's export indices are still very much in decline. Brazil's showing more of an easing. But I think the fascinating thing is, whereas I say the PMIs aren't sentiment indices, there is actually one index, which is a sentiment index in these surveys, which we added quite late on. I think it's about 2012 that we added it, which was, what do you think your own output will be in 12 months' time? Because we were fascinated to see, you know, how does sentiment differ from actuals? And these, we see our own indices differ here. Now, again, these are 50s, no change, if you like. So above 50, you've got more optimists than pessimists. And in August, the business expectations index for Brazil was at 87. So absolutely surging. Yet in Mexico, it was just below 45. So this is huge. Now, you know, if you go back a couple of years, these two indices tend to be sort of in line somewhat. You know, this is quite an unusual divergence in business sentiment. And it's that confidence, I think, that's causing this change. So Brazilian companies seem to have a lot more confidence in their government's handling of this and the support to business that it's providing. And you've got more fiscal stimulus going on in Brazil. They just seem to be more confident that they're out of the woods and they're going to get the support to take them through this tough time, but less evident in Mexico, where they're more worried about the government. It's not such a business-friendly government in Mexico. And I think that's showing in the business sentiment side of it. So they've not got the confidence to start ramping up production to the extent that the Brazilian counterparts have. I think that's playing a big part. As we all know at the moment, trust in governments and confidence is what's going to be a key determinant of recovery speeds here. And this is, I think, where you're seeing the big difference between Mexico and Brazil at the moment.
Okay, well... I think we'd better draw it to a close. We've been very generous with your time, but I mean, just looking forwards with this wealth of data, and whether it's the sort of hard data in the form of the numerical responses, or whether it's the additional comments that come in, which series and what things do you think will be the most illuminating in terms of how the recovery is going to develop going forwards?
Yeah, it's funnily enough, it's not so much the national data that I'm finding interesting at the moment. It's the sector data. Mm. Now, what we can do with the PMIs, because we've got all these 28,000 companies around the world, we can splice the data by country, but also by sectors. And this is where the fascinating picture is appearing at the moment. So go back to April, for example, March, April, and the best performing sectors globally were... Food and drink, healthcare, pharmaceuticals, and paper and timber products, the latter being PPE, right? Your face masks and everything. Right. Exactly as you would expect. It's all about staying alive. It's feeding yourself, healthcare, and so forth. And everything else was being absolutely crushed. Now go back to more recent months, and who's leading the upturn in July? It was the auto sector. Absolutely booming, far outstripping anyone else. And you've now got sectors like real estate, construction materials, household goods, like clothing and so forth, the shops reopening. All these are now, like, if you like, leaderboard. So it's this All this makes perfect common sense, right? It's exactly what you'd expect to see, but it's fascinating that it's being sort of shown in real time, if you like, by the PMIs. So the big thing is, yes, we've had this is exactly what we'd have expected to have happened between Q2 and Q3. This switch around to more cyclical and consumer and housing and so forth sectors. What's going to happen in Q4? That's the big one. And I think it's this sector detail that's going to really add the colour as to who are the winners and who are the losers, what's going to keep driving this expansion and where the fade is going to be seen most obviously. So keep your eye on those detailed sector data, I would say.
Okay, Chris. Well, look, thank you so much for spending the time to take us through this wealth of really, really powerful and useful data, which, as I say, is just an absolute must read for everyone trying to get an idea of how the economy is developing, from policymakers to investors to business people. And thanks also to all of our listeners. Hopefully you found this a useful dig into this data series and the insights of Chris. And hopefully you'll join us again soon on the next Bruin podcast.